This weather lately reminds me of that. I was given something called a Glasgow, or as they would say, a Glasgow Bible. It is written phonetically, as the Scottish people would say the language, and I came today upon the story of the resurrection, as it would be read if you were in Scotland tonight or tomorrow. Should I try it? Early on Sunday morning, Mary Magdalene and Mary the mother of James went to the grave taking sweet smelling ointments to put on the body. And when they got close up to the tomb, the first thing they saw was the huge stone had been moved out the way. Then they went in, kind of feared-like, and all of a sudden two men were standing in front of them. The women were terrified and couldn't even look up. And the men said, "Tell us, why are you searching among the graves for someone who's alive? He's not here. He's come back to life again. Did you not even remember what he said when he told you he was with you in Galilee? That the Christ must be handed over to evil men, nailed to the cross and raised to life on the third day? Then sure they remember what Jesus had told them." And so they raced back in joy to Jerusalem and tell the 11 disciples and all the others, "He's alive. Jesus is alive." You may have thought that that was going to be a... I even forgot the television show now. Scotty. Star Trek episode. But it wasn't. Well, last year at the stadium on Sunday morning, we had about 13,000 people show up to that service. And tomorrow we figure we'll have about 13 people. That would be those of us who are going to be on the platform. No, you know what? We're still going through with it. The stage is all set in the stadium. And I am reminded that at this time, it is a little bit colder than this, where thousands and thousands of refugees are this evening, trying to get out to freedom over in the area of Kosovo, going to Albania. And it's going to be cold, and they're living outside. And so what a privilege it is to get up in the morning and in some way identify with those who are suffering, but identify more than that with the risen Christ. So tomorrow, bright and early, set your clocks ahead so you'll lose another hour of sleep. And come on out to the stadium with us, where the message will be entirely different from the one that is here tonight. However, we are joined, as you know, by 150 radio stations around America who just heard me make a fool of myself. So please wish them a happy Easter. That was great. Turn in your Bibles to John chapter 21 for this evening's study. John chapter 21. As you're turning, let me remind you of somebody that you are familiar with in history when I tell you his name. He failed in business in 1831 and was defeated for the legislature in 1832. He won the subsequent year, 1833, the legislature. But his sweetheart died in 1835, and this man had a nervous breakdown in 1836. He was defeated then for the Speaker of the House in 1838, defeated for the Elector in 1840, defeated for Congress in 43, elected to Congress in 46, again defeated for Congress in 48, defeated for Senate in 1850, defeated for the Vice Presidency in 1856, and for the Senate in 58, but he was elected President in 1860. That's Abraham Lincoln. Now, we think of him as a success, not a failure, but he failed more than he succeeded. But we remember that he succeeded as being the president. One of the most biting words in our language is the word failure. We hate that word. In fact, one of our greatest fears is that we might fail at something. Dream analysts tell us that one of the most common dreams are anxiety dreams, where somebody dreams about a possible situation where they might fail, be it a test the next morning or a speech they have to give, something that they might do that they might fail at. Everyone has experienced failure. In fact, you started life that way. You may not remember that far back, but you did. The first time you tried to walk, you fell. Although you were a success in your parents' eyes, you still fell. You almost drowned the first time you tried to swim. You did not hit the baseball the first time it was pitched to you. You did not make straight A's on your first report card, and if you did, nobody liked you because nobody else did. James was right when he said, we all stumble. We all fail in many ways. It is part and parcel of life. But tonight, I want to talk about, in particular, spiritual failure. We turn to the life of Peter after the resurrection. There have been times where we have felt like, yes, I have failed to be a witness before people for the Lord. I have failed to stand up to temptation. I know what it's like to be defeated. And we hate that feeling. But contrary to that commercial that you may remember a few years back, where they said, I've fallen and I can't get up. If you have fallen, you can get up. Because Jesus is in the business of restoring wrecked lives, even those who have failed for Him. In fact, I've called this message a resurrection restoration. It's a private conversation with Peter and Jesus that includes, though it is for Peter, the other disciples who are standing around. The resurrection restoration. It's not written in John, but in Mark's gospel, the angel gives a message for the women to tell the disciples. The angel says, go tell the disciples and Peter that I'm going to be with them in Galilee. You say, wait a minute, I thought Peter was a disciple. I don't think he felt like one after his denial. Go tell the disciples and Peter. Got a special message for Peter. We're about to read that. Jesus predicted Peter's failure. He said, you're going to deny me three times, which he did. But Jesus also predicted Peter's restoration. He said, Peter, Satan has been asking for you lately, but I've prayed for you. And when you have returned, or when you are restored, then I want you to strengthen your brethren. These words that we read tonight are words to anyone who has ever fallen or failed God. Don't let failure be your undertaker. Let it be your teacher. But then learn to get up and move. Let it be a great hinge point to change your direction. Maybe tonight will be that hinge point. Charles Colson, who worked for Nixon and was arrested and now has prison fellowship, said, the real legacy of my life was my biggest failure, that I was an ex-convict. My greatest humiliation being sent to prison was the beginning of God's greatest use of my life. He chose the one experience in which I could not glory for His glory. This evening, we want to look at John 21, some select verses, and I want to divide it up into two sections. Jesus as a man, and then Jesus as the master. First, in the first few verses, as He comes on the scene, Jesus as a man reveals Himself. And then He takes Peter aside in verse 15, and Jesus as the master restores His disciple. But first of all, He's to them a stranger walking on the shores of Galilee. Jesus the man, He reveals Himself. Let's read the first four verses. After these things, which is the story of the resurrection in the previous chapter, Jesus showed Himself again to the disciples at the Sea of Tiberias. And in this way, He showed Himself, or revealed Himself. Simon Peter, Thomas called the twin, Nathanael of Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and two others of His disciples were together. Simon Peter said to them, I'm going fishing. And they said to him, we're going to go with you. They went out and immediately got into the boat. And that night, they caught nothing. But when the morning had now come, Jesus stood on the shore, yet the disciples did not know that it was Jesus. The instructions to the disciples were, go up to Galilee, Jesus is going to go there as well. They were to wait for Jesus. Well, they're in Galilee. Could be that Peter was impatient, didn't want to wait. Nobody likes to wait long. He'd waited. Then he says, I'm going fishing in verse 3. Perhaps this was impatience. Perhaps this was resignation. It's like saying, you know what? I failed at being his disciple, but there's one thing I'm good at. There's one thing I never fail at. It's my occupation. I'm a fisherman. I'm going fishing. Yeah, man, we'll go with you. But it says that night they caught nothing. They fish at night because at nighttime, the fish feed around the surface of the Sea of Galilee. And even to this day, you'll see boats that go out at night with their lights to catch fish because the fish are near the surface. Except for that night. That was a different night. Fish were not biting. They weren't using the right bait or something. But they caught nothing. Okay, Jesus is on the shore. And he's going to say something, and he's going to do something that's going to be like a trigger to Peter's memory. A memory trigger to bring back something to mind to cause a response. Memory trigger number one is the fishing advice that Jesus gives in the next couple verses. Jesus said to them, "Children, do you have any food?" They answered, "No." And he said to them, "Cast the net on the right side of the boat." So we infer it was on the left side up to this point. "And you will find some." So they cast, and now they were not able to draw it in because of the multitude of fish. I love this. The difference between failure and success was about 4 or 5 feet. Just one side of the boat. Now, it seems weird that you wouldn't catch fish on this side of the boat, but you toss it on that side of the boat, and all of a sudden, there's not a couple fish. There's so many fish that the nets are about to be broken. There's a lesson to be learned in that. It's very successful, their fishing, when it's directed by Jesus. He's giving the commands now. We're going fishing. Catch nothing. Hey, just throw your nets on the other side. A whole net full. Because now their service is directed by Jesus Christ. But there are only two times that we read about in the Bible when Jesus told them to let down their nets and gave them fishing advice. One time is here, although he hasn't revealed himself as the Messiah, as Jesus yet. The other time was at the very beginning of his ministry on the same lake. It was Peter's boat. And Jesus gives a message from Peter's boat. Then he says to Peter, "Peter, let's launch out into the deep and throw your nets down." And remember Peter's excuse? "Lord, we have fished all night and caught nothing." Very similar. "Nevertheless, it's your word. We'll let down the nets. We'll humor you. You know, you're a first-time fisherman, preacher. No problem." Well, you know what happened. They caught so many fish they could hardly contain. Now, when this happened, memory triggered. It's like, wait a minute. There's only one other time we've ever heard of, we've ever experienced, where this has happened like that. And that was at the beginning of Jesus' ministry when he called us. And look at the next verse. "Therefore, that disciple whom Jesus loved," that would be John, we figure. By the way, notice who wrote this book. "Said to Peter, 'It is the Lord.' Now when Simon Peter heard that it was the Lord, he put on his outer garment, for he had removed it, and he plunged into the sea. But the other disciples came in the little boat, for they were not far from the land, but about 200 cubits, dragging the net with the fish. Then as soon as they had come to the land, they saw a fire of coals there, and Jesus and fish laid on it and bread. And Jesus said to them, 'Bring some of the fish which you have just caught.'" You know, there they are fishing in the lake, and John figures it out. Wait, that's the Lord. And Peter just, as an instinct, dives in and swims 100 yards, 4 lengths of a standard lap pool. And you know, you might think that Peter would just turn the other way and go, "Oh, I denied him." Or, you know, "I'm just going to go in slowly in the boat with the other disciples." Not Peter. You know why? Because Peter understood grace. He knew what Jesus was like. He remembered when Jesus said, "Come unto me, all you who labor and are heavy laden." And as soon as John identified him, "That's the Lord," it's like, get into the sea and swim to shore as fast as you can. Because he understood grace, rather than cowering, he came. One of my favorite little sayings was by Nancy Spiegelberg, who said, "Lord, I crawled across the barrenness to you with my empty cup, uncertain in asking any small drop of refreshment. If I had only known you better, I would have come running with a bucket." And even as now, this great catch of fish comes in, and Peter remembers, yeah, I remember when he first called me. That memory trigger works. It's the Lord, and in love, he comes to the shore. Memory trigger number two in revealing who Jesus is the fish breakfast. Jesus said to them, "Bring some of the fish which you have just caught." Simon Peter went up and dragged the net to the land, full of large fish, 153, and also there were so many that the net was not broken. Jesus said to them, "Come and eat breakfast." Yet none of the disciples dared ask him, "Who are you?" knowing that it was the Lord. Jesus then came and took the bread and gave it to them, and likewise the fish. This is now the third time Jesus showed himself to the disciples after he was raised from the dead. First thing he did was give fishing advice. They figured out it's the Lord. Now they know it's the Lord, but he's different than he was before. He's cooking breakfast for them. One of the things I've always loved about Jesus is that he loved food. Now, I'm not saying that to justify my own behavior. Simply that it was a fact. He loved food. He loved to eat. We see him at Matthew's house having a huge feast. We see him at the house of the Pharisee eating dinner. He goes up to Zacchaeus and he says, "Come on down. We're going to go to your house. Get lunch ready." We hear him crying out to the church in Revelation, "I behold, I stand at the door and knock, and if anyone will open the door, I will come in and eat with him, sup with him, and he with me." And that is because, as you know, eating is like one of the most intimate forms of fellowship in the Middle East, the Near East. And to invite people to come and eat, it's like, come into my fellowship. Here's Peter, the failure. He's inviting him to come closer, an intimate fellowship over a meal. Now, this meal must have stirred Peter's memory a bit. No doubt he thought back to all of the meals he had eaten with Jesus the last 3.5 years. He probably would have thought back to the time Jesus fed 5,000 people in one of the hills real close to this area. And there were baskets of fragments left over. He would have no doubt remembered the meal they shared just a few days before this, the Last Supper it is called, the night that Peter went out and betrayed Jesus. Something else I think Peter would have remembered, looking down at the fire that was burning in front of him with the fish on it. He remembered another fire that he was at just a few nights before this, in the courtyard of Caiaphas, the high priest, when before that fire he denied Jesus Christ. And now he is at another fire, about to be restored with his master. So, as a man, Jesus reveals himself. But now as the master, he is restoring his disciple. We turn now to verse 15. This is between Jesus and Peter. Notice, when they had eaten breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter. So this is a conversation between Peter and Jesus, yet, though it's just between them, it's in the midst of Peter's peers. The disciples are listening in on this. And you might think, well, that's kind of embarrassing for Jesus to bring him publicly in front of his peer group and say some of the things he's going to say. You're familiar, no doubt, with much of this story. And we would think it's embarrassing. Why would Jesus do it publicly and not altogether privately? I think it's because of this. Peter denied Jesus publicly. And Jesus is going to give him an opportunity to affirm him publicly. I think it's an act of grace. Charles Spurgeon once said that a man's repentance should be as notorious as his sin. And this is a notorious restoration process. In front of his disciples, they knew about Peter. They knew what he had done. And now in front of them, he's going to reaffirm his love. It's divided into three segments because there's three questions, three answers, and three commands. Jesus asks him if he loves him. Peter responds, and then Jesus gives a command. Verse 15, Jesus said to Simon Peter, "Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me more than these?" He said to him, "Yes, Lord, you know that I love you." He said to him, feed my lambs. Notice there is a question, a reaction, and a commission. And we're going to see that again two more times. He said to him again the second time, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. He said to him, tend my sheep. He said to him the third time, Simon, son of Jonah, do you love me? Peter was grieved because he said to him the third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. I find it significant that he calls Peter not Peter, but what? Simon. Simon was the name that he had before Jesus changed his name to Peter, to Cephas, which means a stone. In fact, Jesus came up to him and said, no longer are you going to be called Simon, which sounds a lot like Simeon. It's a word that means to listen. I'm going to change your name to Rocky. Stone. The Rock. Yet here he calls him Simon, not Cephas. Well, we know from the gospel stories that Peter was anything but a rock. At best, he was a sand dune. I mean, he was shifting every which way. But I think the reason Jesus gave him the name Peter, stone, wasn't because he was one. It's what he could become once Jesus would get a hold of him. He saw the potential in Peter, not in Peter's potential, but as much as what God could do through this guy who is shifting sand, who really doesn't listen to God. I'm going to make you solid, man. I'm going to make you confident. You're going to be a rock. However, he calls him Simon here because we know what happened in the garden. He tried to get a sword and cut off the guy's ear. He denied Jesus three times. Peter thought he was a rock, but he fell. And there's a secret that we should never forget. Whenever we think that the very traits God is developing in us are our own traits that we're developing in ourselves, we're going to fail. And you know what? God will let you fail so that we'll learn the lesson. Without me, you can do nothing. That's what Jesus said. I guess my question to us all is, do you really believe that? I mean, really believe without Jesus, you can do nothing. That's what he said. Peter didn't believe it. There are times, frankly, that I don't believe it, and I fail every time I don't. There's an old anonymous proverb that says, he who looks up to admire his own halo is apt to create more than just a pain in the neck. He'll create havoc. Peter did everywhere he went because he was trusting in himself. And so he asked him the question, Peter, do you love me? You know, I thought of all the questions he could have asked him. Why didn't he say, Peter, do you know me? He would have every right, because Jesus, when he was being betrayed, had Peter in the garden of the high priest saying, I don't even know him. Really? Hi, Peter. Do you know me? Rather, he's asking him the supreme question, not what is your mental assessment or your mental acumen, but Peter, do you love me? And he put it this way, do you love me more than these? Now, we're just reading a narrative here. We don't have the benefit of the body language. Perhaps Jesus pointed to the nets and the boats and the fish and said, hey, Peter, do you love me more than these? These that represent your occupation, your comfort zone. You make a lifestyle out of these things, fishing. Do you love me more than what you're familiar with, your occupation? Maybe Peter wanted to go back to fishing. I failed at discipleship. I failed at evangelism. I'm going fishing. Hey, do you love me more than these? Or it could be that he drew his hand toward the rest of the disciples there and said, hey, Peter, do you love me more than these guys? Peter said he did, didn't he, a few days before? He said, Lord, though everyone else forsakes you, I will never leave you or forsake you. Of course, that's supposed to be Jesus' line, isn't it? But Peter said, I'll never forsake you. In other words, I love you more than these guys. Yet who denied Jesus three times? Peter. Peter, do you love me more than these? That's the first question. There's also something else to note, and if you are familiar with the text, you have probably come upon it. It's often pointed out that there are two words used in the text for the word love. Both of them translated the English word love. Peter, do you love me? Yes, Lord, I love you. But there's two different Greek words. The word Jesus used is the word agapao, agape. The word Peter responded with was phileo. We get the term Philadelphia from it, philanthropist, a brotherly love, a fondness. And there's sort of a rule in the ancient language of Greek that whenever you have two synonyms so close together, they're put there to show you the difference between them. Peter, are you totally committed to me? Lord, I love you, but not with a total commitment, was the response. Let me read this to you in what's called the Wiest translation. It's a Greek literal translation of the New Testament. Peter, do you have a love for me called out of your heart by my preciousness to you, a devotional love that impels you to sacrifice yourself for me? And Peter said, yes, Lord, you know positively that I have an emotional fondness for you.
Concludes side one. Please turn your cassette over at this time.